It's Main Street for this Tuesday. Welcome to the show. I'm Eric Detheridge in for Craig Blumenschein. It's so nice to have you. And we've got a fun one for you today as we share a few stories from The Tell, Fargo's monthly live storytelling event. Tell host Cody Schuler joins me now to share some audio from previous events and tell us about The Tell's origin story.
Tell me something good.
Oh, baby, 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 yeah.
A number of years ago, there was a woman named Laura Eglin who lived here locally in Fargo, and she had the idea to start a storytelling slam inspired by the Moth. And so she rented a space, she put it together, she hosted it herself, and it was a hit. The line would be out the door. It was at the old Studio 222. Laura would sell some premium tables. There was wine and booze, and it was a great time. And Laura was part of the appeal because she was such an amazing host. She always had a story to tell of her own. I used to tease her that being the host of The Tell was probably cheaper than therapy for her because she would talk about her life and her observations on the life. And she was very funny. When Studio 222 went away and they moved over to the old original Drecker site, it just really became about the fabric of, a group of us that felt it was an important part of our community. It really was building community. When Laura started it, she talked about community building and family storytelling being a part of that. And so that really was a part of the core of why she did it and why I think it was so successful. Even people, you came once or if you came every time, there was a feeling of belonging.
You guys are growing and the word of mouth is spreading. The venues are changing. And this is right before 2020, right? As far as the timeline goes, is this right before the pandemic? You guys are starting to grow some success?
Yeah, definitely. Laura had some life changes. She actually left the community. And so a group of us kept it going with my work schedule at the time. I was sort of in and out at different times. And then the pandemic came along and really closed it down. You were in a couple of different venues and ended up it going away for a while. But luckily, there was a group of folks, and they were sort of the stalwarts. They were there every time. They were some of the folks that would buy a table, and they would get their friends together. It was kind of almost an outing for them. And they missed it. And sort of serendipitously, one day I was thinking, like, I really missed The Tell. I wonder if anybody would want to get that going again. I don't know how much time I have to dedicate to it, but, maybe we should look into that. And I mentioned it to somebody, a friend, who said, oh, Carol and Lori and all these folks, that they were talking about bringing it back together. So I reached out to them and said, hey, how can I help?
You get this combination, this cocktail of people and libations and live music. Yeah. And just describe the scene, set the scene for people that have never been there before. You call them virgins, at least in the audience, storytellers too. Yeah. But what's it like there at The Tell?
Yeah, well, first of all, I always joke that it is an opportunity to be a virgin again if you want to be your first time at The Tell. We've moved venues a couple of times, but now I've found a great home at the 4 and 4, which is above Side Street. And it is, set up audience style. And there's, some tables and there's some auditorium style chairs, a stage, lights, a microphone. We have a musician off to the side, a bar off to the side. Folks get their, get their tickets and come on in and find a seat. And then when we get about ready to start, I like to greet everybody. We have some housekeeping, as you do anytime but somebody gathers. So we like to let folks know what the rules are. One of the parts that makes it interesting is that it is a juried storytelling event. It's an opportunity for people in the community to step up and volunteer and get involved in a different way, be a part of the process in a different way. Theater B is one of our partners in that they're bringing and encouraging folks from their organization and from their wider community and the general community to come in and be storytellers. So they're inviting our judges and just gives an opportunity for folks who have sponsored us as well. To be able to participate. We've had judges from Prairie Public and other folks in the community. Yourself, you've been a judge.
Yeah, it's toughest gig I ever had, I have to say.
Yeah.
It's tough.
Yeah.
But a lot of fun seeing.
Yeah, you would think it'd be pretty easy to say, that sounded like a good story.
They were all good the night I judged.
Yeah, we have a time limit, we have a theme, and so folks, there are some, a little few criteria that that people get judged on. However, the judging and the winning isn't the most important part. The important part is people sharing their lives and their stories.
Hey, if you're just joining us, you are listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Detheridge in for Craig. We are devoting part of today to The Tell. Fargo's very cool, very hip, very fun live storytelling event. It takes place at the 4x4 above Side Street Bar and Grill. in downtown Fargo monthly. The host that has been emceeing the most is Cody Schuler. He's with me. Cody, the first story we're going to share is from the most recent one, March 2025. And I should mention, as you, I think, did, each night has a theme. Volunteers' names are drawn out of a hat. And I think the theme that night was, remember, it was Godfather related, right? It was a quote from part three.
From the beginning, the tell has been measured in seasons. So each iteration is a season. And last season was all Beatles songs.
Like Come Together, Get Back.
Yeah. So this, these are all movie quotes. And so the planning, the folks who plan and execute this every time brainstormed movie quotes, and they all kind of went on a board, and here you go.
Well, I should mention our own Matt Olean, resident Godfather expert. He told a very fun story about watching The Godfather as a kid and get hooked onto that. He even gave us a Brando impression. But the story that caught my ear, Cody, was from a North Dakotan who moved to New York City and found the crime rate there pretty low in her neighborhood. Let's listen and find out why. This is Becky Blankish's story.
I didn't know I was gonna do this, so this is very unplanned. But when I was 18 years old, I left Fargo and I moved to Brooklyn, New York. And I went out there to go to school. I used to go to New York in the summers and stay with my sister who lived there, but I was in Manhattan. So Brooklyn was a completely different experience. And where I moved to was Bensonhurst. Bensonhurst, at that time anyway, was a completely Italian mafiosa neighborhood. And I lived in the heart of it. If you ever saw Saturday Night Fever and you saw the beginning where John Travolta is walking down the sidewalk underneath the elevated train, that was filmed very close to the neighborhood where I moved. And the block that I was on, there was a funeral home at the beginning of the street, which was the Rossetti Brothers funeral home. And they sort of created their own clientele. I moved in with a Sicilian family who were very devout Catholics. And occasionally there would be drive-by shootings in the neighborhood. But they told me that I didn't need to worry about anything because it was a nice, safe neighborhood. The mafia people only killed each other. They didn't kill anybody else, so I didn't have to worry about it. At one point, one of the kind of lower level mafiosa bosses got killed, and they had a big funeral at the funeral parlor at the end of the block. And there were just cars and people in these, you know, tacky, big lapelled, wild color silk suits and the pointy-toed shoes congregated around at the end of the block, and hearses with like massive bouquets of flowers and all sorts of things, and people with bulges underneath the suits so you could tell that they had firearms and stuff like that, you know. One of the other things about New York that I think everybody has heard is that it's really hard to find parking spots. And we lived in a row house, which is where they're kind of like townhomes where they're attached on the sides to each other. And we had only one parking spot in front of the house. And people guarded those parking spots just jealously. I mean, it was like a mother lion protecting her cubs. You know, they guarded that parking spot. If you, you know, God forbid, you parked in somebody else's parking spot, they would like kill you, you know. So our next door neighbor, somebody parked a car in their parking spot, and they were really pissed off because it was there for several days. And they finally went to go put a note on the car to tell the person to move their car, and they found there was a body in the car. So they had to call the police, and the police came and yapped, so the guy had been shot in the head and left in the car. So that was pretty interesting. And at the other end of the block, there was, I think it was a Catholic high school. No, it wasn't a high school, it was a grade school. It was called Bishop Kearney. And the kids were out in the playground one day, and some kind of unsavory character was there eyeing the kids in the playground. And the mothers were getting concerned about it. And a day or two later, they found him in the playground, and apparently someone had taken him up to the roof on the school and threw him off the roof. And yeah, so he was dead on the playground. So yeah, it was a nice, safe neighborhood. Never, you know, nobody ever broke into our house. No crime, no problem. And as long as you played by the rules and you didn't bother anybody, it was, you know, it was a nice, safe neighborhood, and it was a good place to live. And I lived there for 15 years, and we never had any problems. And have other stories, but I'm running out of time, so that's it. Thanks for listening.
So that was Becky Blankish's story, the abbreviated version. Cody, it sounds like there might be a sequel, a part two, a part three of that movie. I can't wait.
Yeah, Becky is welcome to come back and continue.
Cody Schuller, the regular host of The Tell, is with me. So you joke, and we joked earlier about you being a semi-permanent host of The Tell.
Yeah.
And I'll give listeners my take on that for a minute. I was a judge, and I was asked to maybe guest host myself one day, and then the first Tell that I saw was with you hosting, and I said to the person that asked me, I said, I can't follow that guy. There's no way I'm going to host the Tell. This guy is too good. He's too funny. So tell us what it is in your life that gave you the experience to be such a funny and, you know, jovial and smart and just quick on the draw MC.
Well, I'm very flattered because I don't think I'm that funny. I just,
I
don't know. I'm just making some life observations or something that comes to mind. Well, going back all the way to college, I was, you know, in speech and those kinds of things in college. And so just, you know, being up in front of people was something that I think early on wasn't in my life, wasn't something that I liked a lot. But you learn and then you adapt. And I've emceed lots of things in my life. And also, I kind of like things to move on in an orderly fashion. And so if my ADHD doesn't get ahead of me and I can stay on what's on the paper, on my cue cards, I like to keep the show moving. I actually came up with the idea of calling myself the semi-permanent guest host. I was actually inspired by Prairie Public, particularly during the pandemic. I'm a Clay Jenkinson fan and would listen to the Jefferson Hour a lot of times, but particularly during the pandemic, it was kind of part of my weekly ritual. And for many, many years, they had the semi-permanent guest host, and one day I thought to myself, and I think Clay even talked about it on an episode, sort of joking around that title was a temporary thing and became a permanent thing, and I was like, maybe that's worth borrowing, and I thought it was kind of funny, and I mentioned it. Nobody seemed to know where it came from. They thought I came up with it, so I was letting people believe that, and kind of ran with it.
All credit where credit is due.
Exactly.
So, Thomas Jefferson himself gave you the inspiration. Clay Jenkinson. Who knew? Now I know. Thanks for that,
It's all
Cody.
Full circle here at Prairie Public.
That's how it happens. It's a big circle of storytelling here on Prairie Public. So speaking of that first Tell that I saw, I was a judge for the first one that I saw back in August. And the very first story I had the pleasure of witnessing came from Kara Cody Braun. And it's a story that really stuck with me to this day.
Kara, come up.
Woo! So, yeah, this story is called The Premonition because it's about a premonition I had one time. So when I graduated from MSUM back in 1990, moved to Brownsville, Texas, and I ended up working as a paralegal and interpreter in a legal office with people from Central America that were applying for asylum. And at that time, I ended up renting a room from this couple who had moved there from the East Coast to live a simple lifestyle. And they were into, they biked everywhere and walked everywhere and had a big garden. And they were like my parents' age, and they were really nice to me. And they loved having people come together in their home. And they would have meals and just invite eclectic groups of people. And they didn't like small talk. They liked talking about like religion, politics, current events, stuff like that. So I stayed with them for a while, then got my own place, eventually moved back up here. And over the next 20 years, I just kept in touch with them via like once a year, send a Christmas card. So that was in 90. In 2010, I was living on a farm north of Winemere where my husband grew up. And it was a July day, and it was really just this beautiful day. And I was home alone with my daughter, and it was the only day she had ever had this one girl come over to play. It was the only time they came together. And this girl's name was Serenity, and it seemed significant because that word just encapsulated the feeling that day. So as they were playing, I walked down to get the mail, and I was just taking in the serenity. It was like there was no wind, there were no tractors, there were no loud machinery, nobody around. It was just like the perfect temperature. It was just beautiful. And all of a sudden I had this vision, and it was just really realistic, and it was of Gene and Ruth, the couple back in Brownsville, and I saw them riding their bikes down Highway 18 by our farm. And it was so real that when I got to the mailbox, I looked up and down the highway to see if they were really coming. But there was nobody. There was no traffic, nothing. So I went back up to the house, made some lunch for the girls. And then I sat down to read the newspaper. And the girls went back outside to play. And all of a sudden, I heard this loud voice. Hello! And I looked out my front window, and it was Gene on his bicycle. At this point, Gene is 70 years old. He still lives in Brownsville, as far as I know. And I just couldn't believe it. So I ran out and I said, where's Ruth? Because that was part of my vision. He said, no, she didn't come. She's in Maine visiting her kids. I said, how did you get here? What is happening? And he said, oh, I took a train to Fargo. And then I went and rented a bike. And I rented it. It's from that bike shop by the railroad, and I told the guy I was going to visit you, and that guy happens to be an acquaintance of mine. So he's like, hey, I know her, which was weird. So then he got the bike, and he's a guy who didn't like technology and stuff, so he has no phone. He knows my address, but he doesn't know where it is in relation to Fargo. He likes to get around by asking people, so he just starts pedaling. He goes out to the tourism center in Fargo. And he says, I'm going to go visit my friend Kara. She lives in north of, or around Winemere. She has a farm in Winemere. Well, I didn't know this woman working there, but she knew me. It turns out she's from Winemere. And she knows my husband's family. She says, oh, I can tell you exactly where her farm is. So she sends him on his way. And then he stopped one more time on the way from the tourism center to our farm, stopped and asked, and that person also knew how far away he was, so kept ushering him on. So I just couldn't believe this story. So I'm like, well, are you going to stay for dinner? Are you staying overnight? You know, we have an extra room. No. He says, I got to get back to Fargo, because it took him like 4 hours to get there. And now it's late afternoon after we visited, and he's going to head back. So I'm kind of worried about him, like, are you sure? He says, yeah, I'm going to hitch a ride. I'm like, it's not the 1970s. I don't think anybody's going to pick you up. But he is just totally confident. So I was worried. He didn't have a phone, so I wouldn't have a way to check with him if he got back. But I knew I was going to Fargo in a couple days. So I said, let's meet up for lunch. And I said, I picked a Bosnian restaurant. I thought he'd like it. And so we decided to meet there 2 days. So I'm just worrying about him. I show up there in 2 days, and there he is. I'm like, how'd it go? Did you get a ride? I did, he said. The guy who drives the mail truck from Fargo to Winemere, he picked me up. And I'm like, really? And he goes, yeah. And guess what? He's from Bosnia. So he goes, I invited him here today. So I'm like, great. So I got to meet that guy, and we all came together for lunch. And we were eating lamb. And so Gene, he likes to talk to everybody, so he's talking to the owner of the Bosnian restaurant and saying how great this lamb is. So then I'm telling him, yeah, actually, we're going to start raising lamb. And he goes, oh, well, keep in touch. He ended up buying lamb from us. So, like, everything just kept coming together. Oh, and so my takeaway from this story is that, I don't know, everything's connected, I think, and it all comes together.
That was Kara Cody Braun's story about a premonition and the connectivity of people in this region. Lots of serendipity in that story. Hope it moved you like it did me. Hi there, I'm Eric Dethridge for Craig Blumenschein, and we are doing a special live tell version of Main Street. The Tell is a monthly live storytelling event in downtown Fargo. Oh, and speaking of Cody, we have a semi-permanent guest host of The Tell, Cody Schuler, in with me. Cody, a story like that really kind of brings forth the community of the Fargo-Moorhead area, North Dakota in general. It's always so much fun to hear.
Yeah, and what I love is the range of stories that we hear at The Tell. You hear people stand up and tell something from the heart, something that's really central to who they are, something that's very personal, and then you'll have someone who stand up and tell a very funny story. And one of our rules is that it needs to be a true story.
True.
And so,
yeah, no embellishment.
There's no embellishment. I mean, I think sometimes maybe take certain liberties. It's easy to take liberties, right, with the way you remember things, but it really needs to be the way that you remember it, the way that it is, and true. And it has to be, you know, from your personal experience. You can't tell somebody else's story. I've been over the years, especially when I think back to the early days of The Tell, I think there were people who sometimes thought, like, oh, you know, if I'm not funny, I can't stand up and tell. I'm so glad that we've really disavowed ourselves of that we've really come to a place where folks can just tell and be who they are. Yeah, we all love to laugh. It's good medicine. But at the end of the day, a story is a story. And whether you found it fantastic or whether you found it like, well, that didn't necessarily entertain me as much, it still was important.
Yeah, it's that authenticity, that vulnerability that makes you lean into a tell story when you see it live. It's always a compelling experience. We're going to hear more from Cody Schuler, the semi-permanent host of The Tell, in the next half of Main Street. Coming up, a tell story about how to properly wear a girdle. And remember staying home sick as a kid and how some days you weren't actually sick? You'll hear a childhood story about not being believed. But first, let's catch you up on some regional news. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge, in for Craig Blumenschein. Later in the show, the latest episode of our bite-sized weekly podcast about the 69th legislative session in session. And Alquist and I will ask the question, does Governor Kelly Armstrong's property tax relief initiative look anything like what he proposed at the outset? But first, we continue our conversation with the lively host of The Tell, Cody Schuler. The Tell, if you're just joining us, is a live storytelling event. Their next one in downtown Fargo is at the 4x4 this Thursday night. That's right above Side Street Bar and Grill. Cody shares a Ferris Bueller-esque story from the March Tell event. And if you've ever faked sick to watch The Price is Right like me, you can relate to this one from Thomas Kwame.
I woke up feeling nauseous, but my mom said I still had to go to school. Looking back, I don't blame her for not believing me, because me and my brothers definitely lied about being sick to get out of school. I remember one time I did a whole report about dinosaurs the day it was due while sitting in the pediatrician's waiting office. So it made sense for her to not believe me, but I said, no, Mom, I really think I'm gonna throw up. And she touched my forehead with her hand for a half of a second and said, you don't have a fever, you're going to school. And so to make matters worse, not only was she forcing me to go to school, but I had to go in early that day because I was on the school patrol. If you're not familiar with the school patrol, it's an elite tactical unit made up of fourth graders. We were geared up with a belt, with an integrated sash, with a badge on it. If they were out today, I'm sure they'd be high-vis. I don't think high-vis had been invented back then, so they were just red. But we also had a flag that anytime somebody wanted to cross the road to get to school, we would raise our flag, hold it out into the road, and stop any traffic that was going to come. Because apparently the only way to prevent children from getting run over by cars is slightly older children. So I did my morning school patrol duty, and I still didn't feel well, and so I spent the day just trying to survive. I moved as little as possible. I didn't play any games at recess. I didn't even goof off in class. I just sat there hoping that I could make it through the day without throwing up. And as we neared the end of the day, I thought I might make it. My hope started to rise. I wasn't feeling better, but I was just closer to the end, and I was like, I think it'll be okay. And school patrol got out of class 5 minutes before the last bell to go gear up. And so I can't tell you the name of the school I went to, because then you could know my online security passwords for everything. But all the first through fourth grade classrooms were in a long hallway, and the fourth grade rooms were clustered on one end. And then on the very end of that hall was where our school patrol gear was. So my walk to gear up was about 30 feet, but as I started that walk, it seemed to stretch into forever. Every step, my stomach started to churn worse and worse. I got to the end of the hall, and I knew it wasn't going to be good, and so I turned to Mr. Nigg, the school patrol supervisor, and I said, I don't think I can do school patrol today. I think I'm going to throw up. And he believed me much quicker than my mom did, and he dismissed me to go to the nurse, and I start walking back down that infinitely long hallway. And I made it about 30 feet until I was right in between all four fourth grade classrooms, and I erupted. And it kept coming, and it spread like a volcanic lava flow, just slow and unstoppable, until it blocked all four of the fourth grade doors. And that's when the bell rang for the end of school. So all these kids, excited for their freedom, fling the doors open, ready to go out, and they're stopped in their tracks by this ever-expanding ooze, with a seemingly infinite puddle of vomit with me standing in the middle of it. They're all stuck there, waiting for a janitor. He eventually comes wheeling a mop bucket. When he sees the scene, he sighs and just turns around and walks away. Luckily, he came back. He had exchanged his mop bucket. He came back with a giant bag of sawdust over one shoulder and a snow shovel in the other hand. And he slowly, meticulously spreads the sawdust over this mess that I had made, and then scoops and scrapes and clears the rubble from this volcanic eruption, all while all the fourth graders are stuck in their classroom doors, waiting and watching and trapped. And so because every single fourth grader couldn't get out of class, none of the buses could leave either. And so every single student was delayed about 15, 20 minutes getting out of school that day. So I started the morning just wanting to stay home from school, and I ended the day making it so that nobody could go home from school. But the plus side was, after that, my mom was much more likely to believe me when I said I was sick and needed to stay home.
That's a Tell a Story from March by Thomas Kwame, whose mom should probably believe him now if he says he's sick. I'm Eric Dethridge. Cody Schuler, the live host of The Tell, is with me. It is a judged panel that witnesses these stories and chooses a winner at the end. What kind of criteria are they grading on?
primarily whether the judges themselves enjoy the story. There is a time limit that's put on. We don't pull anybody off stage if they go over, but we do time the stories. And so whether you're over or under might play a factor. I think how good the story is might sometimes trump that a little bit, but usually the story does. There is a theme. People are encouraged to tell whatever story, even if it's loose. The theme really is supposed to be a guide, a spark. And I can remember actually years ago, one of the first times that I ever judged, one of the best stories of the night was not on the theme at all. And there were several really good stories that were on theme. But I think some of us as judges were like, well, now we debate back and forth. And so I think we do say staying on theme, staying within the time frame. These are things that might get you the honor of the bragging rights of saying I won that night.
Sure. So there was a band in the 1990s, kind of a swing revivalist band. Remember Big Bad Voodoo Daddy, Cherry Poppin' Daddies, those guys? Anyway, they were called the Asylum Street Spankers, and their album, I'll never forget this, is called Spanks for the Memories. And that could be the title of this uproarious tale from back in August, and the teller is Beth Renner. And Cody, the actual title was Spanks Me.
We have another, I'm excited. Beth Renner, if you want to stand and come to the stage. And Beth is going to tell us a story called Spanks Me with an X, which I'm excited about. So come on over, Beth.
So I set my watch to the yoga setting right now, and my heart rate's at 128, so we'll see how this is gonna go. I put my name in the hat, and I said to the guy, God, do not draw my name. Okay, so I grew up in a large family, 8 kids, and I have 4 brothers. But I used to hang out with my brothers all the time, and I, from the early ages, I hated to wear a dress. Okay, so much so that when it would come time to go to church, I would purposely throw myself into the gravel and skin my knees, and they'd be bleeding, and my mom says, well, now you can't wear a dress. And I'm like, First Communion, I kid you not, if you saw my First Communion photo, you would see me in a blue leisure suit that my mother made for me. She was extremely supportive of this, right? When I was 10 years old, she gave me a football helmet because she was so worried about my face being damaged from my brothers, okay? But what happened, I graduated from college. It was a beautiful family day. I was the first one of the family to graduate from college. My mother and father are sitting there, and she said, I'm so proud of you. And then she says this, I hope you get a job where you have to wear a dress every day to work. And I'm like, are you me? 4 years of college, bust my ass, and this is what you're gonna say to me? So, what do? I choose a job, banking. What do you have to do in banking? You have to wear suits to work every day, and when I went into banking, women wore skirt suits every day, right? So, here we go. I choose my profession as having to wear a dress every day. So, I go into more responsibilities for work. I end up going to Philadelphia. I travel all over on the East Coast. I go to Philadelphia for a big divisional meeting. Anybody been to Philadelphia? Market Street, very business oriented. Everybody's marching along in their suits, right? Very serious. I have a big meeting, so I thought to myself, I'm going to do something extra. This is when Spanx first came out. Yep. Control top pantyhose were not enough for me. I needed to put another layer on, and I put Spanx on. But little did I know it's really important to get the order of them right. Gals, you know where I'm going with this, right? Yeah. You put them on in the wrong order, and you're going to have a big problem. I put them on the wrong order because I didn't know, because I hated wearing dresses all the time. So I had to go from my hotel to the office, which was about a quarter a mile. And I had put on my Spanx first and then my pantyhose. They don't stay up. Pantyhose don't stay up. So I'm marching on Market Street, and all of a sudden I feel something. And I'm like, huh, something's not right. something's really not right. I'm in my skirt, and I am at the stoplight, and I have to get to the other building. And I'm like, it's 50 yards. You can do this. So I start to put my knees a little closer together. And I come to the office for my big divisional meeting, and I go up to the gal at the desk. Hey, do you know where the restroom's at? So she points me to the restroom, and off I go, just like this. And by this time, I'm holding my nylons between my knees. But I still got my Spanx on. Okay. I go into the restroom, I take those nylons, throw them in the garbage, and all I was hoping for is that my Spanx and nylons would come together.
Beth Renner's story about how to properly wear Spanx. Not that I would know, but I do have a little experience with Spanx. Cody Schuler, the semi-permanent host of The Tell, whom we're talking to on Main Street about The Tell, the live storytelling event in downtown Fargo. So my ex from a long time ago, well, she used to wear Spanx, and they were really hard to get on, and sometimes I would help her. It was such a struggle. I felt so bad for her wearing that, and I thought, like, you know, maybe men need a version of that. And I said, oh, maybe we could call it Manx, you know, like Seinfeld, the bro.
Exactly.
All right, I'm going to trademark that, folks. Yeah. So every winner of The Tell gets a chance to display their storytelling chops again this summer, right, in July.
Yeah, yeah. We end every season with The Tell-Off, and The Tell-Off does not have a theme. All the same rules apply, true story, stick within the time limit, but you don't get a jumping off point. You are free to come and tell whatever you want. Also, you know you're going to be up on stage, so you have some time to think, some time to craft, to practice. So it really is just putting some of the folks who have told really good stories an opportunity to put their storytelling on display in a different way. I've always loved that sort of season finale, if you will, where people can come up there and craft something from the heart. It's still a little bit more spontaneous. It's not quite like what you hear on the final product of right. The Moth. So it's still got a storytelling slam, a little bit of impromptu, but it does give people a chance to come together, you know, because you still can't bring any notes.
I was going to say,
you know, no notes.
Like the Moth, no notes, yeah. No net, no nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's bravery right there.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think, you know, we haven't mentioned this, but one of the other parts that's really great is that we also have an opportunity to showcase musicians.
Yeah. What kind of bands have you had on and musicians in general?
Like, yeah. Over
the
years.
What are the styles? Who are the people?
Yeah. Over the years, it's been oftentimes solo acts. This time we had a duo this last time that they were absolutely fantastic. You know, Darren Wentz was somebody who, a local musician, who was a part of the original set of musicians who's been back a number of times. And it's been fun. Of course, I always I like to tease him because I think the first time might have been the first time I hosted. You know, we had a little back and forth about whether he was Carson Wentz's dad or not, because he gets that a lot when people say his last name. And so
I remember that
we had fun with that a little bit. And, you know, so I like having the musicians because it gives me an opportunity to banter with somebody. I would banter with the judges a little bit. Sometimes I banter with the timekeeper who's down in the front, or sometimes I banter with the last storyteller. It makes it kind of fun for me to be able to riff off with somebody or get a little bit of feedback from the audience about what's going on.
Well, I was just so impressed. I mean, it's great people, great vibes, great entertainment. It's moving. It's funny. It's The Tell, the live monthly storytelling event at the 4x4 above Side Street Grill and Pub in downtown Fargo. Next one is this Thursday, April the 10th. And Cody, give folks some details about how they can find more information on Tell shows.
Well, we are on Facebook and on Instagram. Yeah, we always have a photographer as well who snaps some pictures, and so those always show up on socials as well, so people can share and say, you know what, this is a really great experience. I'd love to go. Can make it a part of a date night,
a friend night out.
Mm-hmm. It's a good time.
Yeah, girls' night out, guys' night out, whatever. It's a great time. 7 p.m. At Side Street in downtown Fargo. And Cody Schuler, the semi-permanent host, has joined me for this hour. Thanks so much for sharing these stories and stories about The Tell. It's really a fantastic event, and we're thrilled to be a part of it at Prairie Public.
Yeah, it's a pleasure, and we're glad to have Prairie Public support.
stretch of the 69th legislative session. What are they talking about now?
Amendments. A lot of amendments.
On this week's episode of In Session, we catch you up on property tax relief. And, well, like many things that we would like to be simple, they're just not.
I love that analysis of how the debate over property tax relief has evolved. Because the homeowners, it seems like it should be really simple. But the debate came down to how to be fair.
So to be fair, we need to know that we already have many primary residences that do not and will not have any skin in the game.
It's hard to be fair. Who was that speaking in?
Senator Rummel from Dickinson. He was speaking Thursday on the Senate floor opposing an amendment to 1176. That's the property tax relief bill that has a couple areas of contention. But let's just have a quick refresh of this bill. It would provide or pay for property tax, provide relief from the earnings of the legacy fund, so not the general operating fund.
Takes only the legacy fund dollars to fund the primary residence property tax credit. There's no general fund needed at the level of $1,250 per residence.
So that's Senator Beckedahl from Williston on the Senate floor introducing the bill.
Well, it sounds pretty simple and exactly what Governor Armstrong wanted, pulling from the legacy fund's earnings to provide property tax relief. What has been so complicated to get this across the finish line?
Let's get back to Senator Rummel.
Again, this amendment will benefit higher valued primary residences and penalize the lowest value primary residences.
And it does that in this amendment by having language that says your tax credit doesn't go towards any local levy. Like if your town or your city approved a school bond paid through local property taxes. So this amendment has been referred to as the skin in the game amendment because it's structured to make sure local communities are still paying, still putting in their own dollars to pay for local projects. So Senator Rummel did the math on the Senate floor.
Primary resident has a $1,400 property tax bill. $250 of that is the school bond amount and $150 worth of special assessments. That leaves a balance of $1,000. Since this amendment has a limit of 75% of property taxes, minus the voter-approved mill levy and specials, the credit they will receive is $750. And the primary resident will pay the remaining, the school bond of $250 plus $150 in specials and 25% of the remaining property tax for a total of $650. Many primary residences in North Dakota have total property taxes that are much higher than $1,400. Primary residents will need to understand that voter-approved bond issues will always be their responsibility.
He's saying that this amendment reduces the property tax relief for residents in homes that are valued less, which are mostly going to be homes in rural areas.
Exactly. And
the payments for the bonds and special assessments under House Bill 1176 will continue to be paid by those who voted for those mill levies and are benefiting from the special assessments. That portion of each individual property tax bill will not be reduced by the primary resident credit.
And they'll still have to pay what property taxes are so good at. They're that reliable source of dollars to pay for local things like getting a bigger jail or fixing the school roof. This was always going to be the struggle of figuring out property tax relief. Who's going to pay for those local projects? And this amendment gets around that question by requiring local governments to have their residents still foot the bill for voter-approved levies. But it doesn't provide the tax relief that residents would have hoped for.
This is Governor Armstrong's baby. He opened up the legislative session taking this on. What's his take on all these changes and amendments?
It's really hard to get into the nuts and bolts when you're still fighting about how high the cap is, where it's mills, whether it's a credit, where it's at.
The governor always said the long-term goal was to completely eliminate property taxes over 10 years. But these amendments have bogged down the process.
People want property tax relief. They want reform. They want it on their primary residences. We've worked very closely with many different members of the North Dakota legislature to get us to this point. It would be a shame if it got stuck in the mud now.
Wow, stuck in the mud. I imagine this is kind of a hit for Governor Armstrong. At least he must look at it this way, because when he announced it, it was viewed as a pretty big, bold measure. It even got some bipartisan support. And so I thought, like, well, okay, this might actually have some legs. But as usual, in a legislative process, things get amended, whittled down, compromised on, and this is where we are. So he called it being stuck in the mud. Strong words coming from Governor Armstrong against these amendments. And the Senate voted Thursday on the amendments and the bill. So did Governor Armstrong get his way?
No. The amendments were approved. And 1176 was approved as well with those amendments in place.
All right. So property owners, homeowners are wondering what happens next.
Well, because the House bill is so different now from the Senate bill, it'll have to go into conference committee and be reconciled.
Okay, and if it still includes those amendments?
The governor could sign it, he could veto it. As our news director Dave Thompson likes to say, stay tuned.
Let's take a look at our numbers for the week.
So double, as in doubling the budget of the Ethics Commission. State Senator Mathern proposed it in response to the number of complaints the Ethics Commission has received since the start of the year. So just for comparison, last month, Executive Director Rebecca Binstock told lawmakers she's received 59 complaints since January 1. Compare that for the total of 41 complaints she received for all of 2024.
That sounds like a dive that we have to get deep into. Why the number of ethics complaints this year? Why have they gone so far up? Like, what are the complaints? Very curious. Second number today in.
90 minutes, that's how long State House representatives spent debating what's called the Truth in Sentencing bill that was desired by Attorney General Drew Wrigley. He wanted to make changes to state prison sentences and tougher penalties for fleeing and assaulting law enforcement, and that got defeated.
And that's got to be a big defeat for the AG. And I've got a number, it is 60, as in we're looking at potentially hitting a high of 60 degrees this week. Spring we can finally say has officially sprung.
That sounds pretty good to me.
Hope you enjoyed this week's episode of In Session. Tay Calloway is our radio studio operator. Christine McClellan is our communications manager. And Leah Peterson is our digital communications specialist. Get out there and enjoy this warm weather. I'm Eric Deatherage.
And I'm Ann Alquist. See you next week. This is Dakota Datebook for April 8th. Wildfires have historically played an important role in the ecology of the Great Plains. Fires on the plains help remove accumulated litter, stimulate native grass growth, and slow the spread of invasive plants. However, fires in North Dakota were not limited to the open prairie. Entire cities were destroyed. Early businesses and homes were built with wood, and even the sidewalks were wooden. In 1893, Fargo was devastated by a fire that destroyed 31 blocks of homes and businesses, leaving more than 160 acres in ashes. Bismarck also suffered a major fire in 1898, leaving much of the city in ruins, with most businesses burned to the ground. It was clear something had to be done. Many towns passed laws requiring new buildings to be constructed with brick rather than wood. Fire departments were established. Towns also began considering additional safety measures. On this date, in 1766, the first fire escape was patented. Instead of a ladder, it was a wicker basket on a chain. This initial design was followed by many others. One version was a bridge connecting the upper floors of apartment buildings so occupants could escape to a neighboring building. Another was a chute that allowed people to slide to safety. The fire escape has come a long way since then. The most practical design turned out to be the metal stairway, or ladder we are familiar with today. North Dakotans started considering this approach. In 1908, the Williston School Board decided it would be a good idea to install a fire escape so students on upper floors would not have to use interior stairways. They agreed to install a good steel fire escape. Fire safety has improved significantly over the years. Today, smoke alarms are considered the first line of defense in case of fire. They're required in public buildings and are common in homes. Fire prevention experts remind us to be aware of escape routes in unfamiliar buildings. While this is often an interior stairway, we can all be thankful that the exterior fire escape has come a long way since the original wicker basket. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. I'm Eric Etheridge, and for Craig Blumenschein, thanks for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.